From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program, Ambassador András Simonyi, former Hungarian ambassador to the United States, currently non-resident senior fellow with the Global Energy Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank based in Washington. According to the Atlantic Council website, Ambassador Simonyi served as ambassador to the United States from 2002 to 2007. Prior to this post, he was the first Hungarian ambassador to NATO shortly after the country's accession to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. His previous assignments include Deputy Chief of Mission of Hungary to the European Union. Ambassador Simonyi was the managing director of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins University from 2012 to 2018. He currently works with the George Washington University School of Engineering and Applied Science. Ambassador Simonyi is a trained transportation economist with a PhD in international affairs. He specializes in transatlantic relations, transatlantic energy, and the Nordic countries. Therefore, we are delighted to welcome him as this week's newsmaker to discuss the ramifications of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, NATO and the EU's approach to combating Russian aggression, Ukraine's request to join the European Union, how to wean the continent off Russian energy to deprive Moscow of the revenues it uses to finance its war machine, and much more. Ambassador András Simonyi joins us from Brussels via Microsoft Teams. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Likewise. Ambassador, let's start with the most basic, which is Russian aggression in Ukraine. Of course, we're talking about the invasion in February, which is really a continuation of its invasion of Ukraine, of the Donbas area back in 2014. How do you assess the war, this aggression so far, and how the West is approaching punishing Russia and trying to get it to back off?
Well, first, let's be very clear. We sleepwalked into this war, and I am kind of saddened by the fact that for all the years, some of us have been warning about the dangers of a resurgent Russia that will be aggressive, that will want to attack its neighbors, that will want to restore the former Soviet Union. Nobody was listening. I would strongly argue that the writing was on the wall. So some of us were definitely not surprised when on the 24th of February, Russian tanks started rolling into Ukraine. Now, I have to tell you that for me, this does have a very, very special meaning. I was 4 years old when Russian tanks rolled into the streets of Budapest in November 1956 and squashed the Hungarian Revolution, which was aimed at kicking out the Russians from Hungary and pushing out communists from power. So I do have some memories of how the Russians attack countries, how the Russians roll into countries that are a lot weaker. The big surprise, and I guess even I am very much surprised, is how strongly the Ukrainians have reacted, how well prepared the Ukrainians were, and no one would have predicted that the Ukrainians would be able to push back so hard. This is a very, very positive surprise, and let's see what happens. These days, we're all anxious to see what the next steps will be from Russia. But I have to say that the Western reaction has been a lot more unified and tougher and stronger than obviously Vladimir Putin had expected. I personally feel that sometimes we're doing too little too late, but that's just a very personal meaning. All in all, I think the West has reacted properly, and without Western support, Ukraine would not have been able to hold out as long as it has.
Well, you certainly aren't alone, Mr. Ambassador, in your point of view that we, that is the West, as you said, sleepwalked in a sense into this. The Baltic states were warning, you know, for over a decade about Russia's intentions vis-a-vis, you know, Europe and Ukraine in particular. We are where we are. And as you said, rather than destabilize Europe, Vladimir Putin seems to have united the West, NATO, and the EU. Let's talk about where we go from here. We know that Russia pulled back from Kyiv, and of course now Russia's in the Donbass and in there to win. There's this date, May 9, that Russia celebrates as the end of World War II, the victory. And many analysts say Putin is looking for, you know, some sort of victory. So other historians are also saying that the West have to talk about winning now. The West has sent many arms, enormous assistance to Ukraine, even though President Volodymyr Zelensky is always asking for more, understandably. How important is it for Ukraine and by extension the West to win? And what does that mean? Because this is really, many analysts also have said, you know, a fight not just for Ukraine, but for democracy writ large, particularly in Europe.
The victory of Ukraine is really important to all of us. This is not just about freedom and democracy, two words that have become throwaway comments in most part of the West. Yes, it is about freedom and democracy, but it's also about modernization. It's about freeing the abilities of a country to build a modern society, to make a contribution to solving the world's problems. And so, if you want, the Ukraine problem is more than just about Ukraine. It really is about the future of what I would call enlightened and liberal societies versus dictatorial authoritarian regimes. And so I would say that while the Ukrainians are fighting a war and they are fighting a battle for survival, they're actually also fighting a war for all of us. And that is why I think they need to get all the help, all the support, all the arms we can give them so that they can win this war. I do feel that this war is winnable, even if Vladimir Putin cannot survive an actual defeat. Much will depend on how much more the Russian population will be able to tolerate the suffering. The fact is that Russians have been living under terrible circumstances under the Tsar. They have been living in a poor society under Stalin, not much better under Brezhnev. And so they say, what's new? So for them, they can survive a lot more hardship than Western European or Western, including American society, can. They cannot survive hardship forever. And even dictators need to abide by the social contract. The social contract for Vladimir Putin is that I feed you and you shut up. But when he breaks the social contract that I don't feed you and you have to shut up, that is not going to work forever. So the question is, how long can Vladimir Putin and his propaganda machine feed nonsense and lie to the Russian people? And how long the support for this war will go on in Russia? We're all playing for time. You mentioned May 9th. That might be a day when Putin would like to show off his victory, his gain. I'm not sure he will be able to. But let's hope that the time is near when he will understand this war is unwinnable for him and he will suffer not just military losses, but incredible economic losses. And then he might be forced to stop.
Ambassador Simonyi, there's also the other question about how long can the West maintain the pressure, because we are suffering quite a bit of inflation. It's costly also for Europe and for the United States and other countries who are imposing sanctions. Russia is a key supplier, as you know, of commodities as varied as energy, grain, and metals. So are you confident that the West can keep up the pressure? Because that is an important part of the equation.
It all hinges on leadership. I do believe that our leaders have not been honest to our peoples, because at the outset, it should have been made very clear that this is a war. This is a damaging war. We cannot stay out of it. and it will have costs. And if we do not want to be involved militarily, then we will have to understand that we will need to use as much economic pressure as possible. This will have consequences. This will have consequences at the gas pump. This will have consequences in the stores. The price of bread will go up. The price of meat will go up. Inflation will grow, but we have to be honest about it. I believe people are mostly smarter than politicians think they are. And I think people would understand, but it needs strong leadership, courageous leadership, and honesty that this is a war we are fighting because it is about our own future as well. So I guess, look, the population, and including the United States, the people in the United States, have reacted with an enormous empathy towards the Ukrainians. And I'm even surprised by it. And this gives me hope that our populations can survive even more costs, but it has to be explained to them. This is a war. And once again, this is a war. The Ukrainians are fighting on behalf of all of us. There will be consequences. And it's not fair that just only a few countries, mainly the Central and Eastern European countries, will bear the burden and the consequences of this war.
Okay, we'll have more in just a moment. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador András Simonyi, former Hungarian ambassador to the United States and non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to our loyal listeners all across the Russian Federation, and we hope you can hear us. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Ambassador András Simonyi. And Mr. Ambassador, you know, I said hello to our listeners in Russia and hoping they can hear us because, as we know, there's a huge crackdown, a total ban on any independent media that may have remained under Vladimir Putin's regime. And of course, that is one of the big problems. They're not getting the truth. They're being fed with propaganda and the most perverse type. Putin is referring to Ukrainians as Nazis, when in fact, one could argue that it is Putin who is doing that, which the Nazis did to Ukraine, you know, in World War II. There are allegations, very credible ones, of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Bucha, Mariupol, and elsewhere. So I suppose time will tell to what extent Russians will finally get a sense of the truth. What is your take on the propaganda tactics that Putin has really doubled down on? Almost, I would argue, taking a page from Joseph Goebbels under Hitler, Goebbels being his chief propagandist.
Yeah, and then you could mention Mr. Suslov or Comrade Suslov, who was the chief propaganda person in the Soviet regime. And what Putin is doing is, in the best tradition of good old communist propaganda, a modernized version with the same purpose, to isolate the Russian people from the truth, to isolate the Russian people from the world. And I want to be very clear that we need to do more to explain to the Russian people that what is happening in Ukraine is also about their future. They can choose a future of prosperity or a future of poverty. And that is really something that we, with our means of communications, have to get through. Voice of America is playing an incredibly important role. I grew up on listening to Voice of America and Radio Free Europe. Of course, at that time, the real reason we tuned in was because there was a lot of good old rock and roll music broadcast on both. But joke aside, I think one thing we have been really mistaken is to think that with the advent of social media and the internet, the propaganda machine of a dictatorial regime could be easily broken. And that's just not happening. But I think it's doable. And I think it is important to support those in Russia and outside of Russia, Russians, Russian patriots who are trying to do their best to break the monopoly of Vladimir Putin's communication machine, just like it was possible to break the monopoly of the communist regimes 30 years ago.
Mr. Ambassador, I want to turn now to the need to wean Europe off Russian energy sources, because even though we have a very harsh sanctions regime on Russia's central bank, on the SWIFT system, on so many important imports that they would need for manufacturing technology and so forth, and that has really adversely affected Russia. What about dependence on Russian energy? I mean, right now, Russia's oil and gas sector provides as much as 40% of its country's federal budget revenues, 60% of the country's exports. And we know that, of course, the United States' ban on Russian energy is taking place on April 22nd, but we don't really import a significant amount. It's really Europe, Germany in particular. How realistic would it be? How important would it be for the European Union and Germany in particular to begin to really wean itself from Russian energy sources? Is that an important missing piece? Could that be the so-called straw that broke the camel's back? And do you foresee this happening?
This is the most critical question in terms of turning the Russian aggression around. So far, we have imposed a lot of sanctions that are working, but they're not hitting as hard as a ban on Russian oil and gas imports would. The real question we need to sooner or later discuss, frankly and honestly, is how we got here. How is it that a big part of Western Europe, mainly Germany, became so dependent on Russian gas supplies? Why is it that the warnings not to build the Nord Stream 2 pipeline were not heeded? Why is it that those who were critical about the level of dependence on Russian gas, people who were signaling a disaster, were laughed at? And, you know, I mean, we never, Germany in particular, never took this seriously. But having said that, I think it would be really important to sanction Russian oil and gas imports, and that would really make a difference. Right now, Europe is, on the one hand, supporting Ukraine. The United States is supporting Ukraine with arms. At the same time, Europeans are financing Russia through their payment of importing Russian oil and gas. And so that has to stop. It is also obvious that Europe, long term, will have to figure out how to look for alternative sources, which it is doing already, and how to speed up the energy transition to use less fossil fuels in the future. It's complicated, but, you know, this is yet another thing where leaders in Europe have to be very frank about this and tell the population that, hey, you will have to turn off the heating by 1, 2, maybe 3 degrees, and that will make a huge difference. And it would be totally possible to stop the import of gas immediately.
Right now, Russia's energy imports are worth nearly $1 billion a day. And of course, that's what keeps Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin and its aggression on Ukraine a very important question. And we know that the European Union is looking into alternatives. It's just that it's not happening fast enough, it seems. Let's turn briefly to the state of the European Union as well as NATO. I mean, now states like Finland and Sweden, who were more neutral, are requesting membership. What are the implications of that, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, the implications are huge. I've always been a great supporter of Finland and Sweden joining NATO, and I've been campaigning for this for a while. I have been visiting Helsinki and Stockholm to talk about this. And at that time, only a minority of political parties and a minority of the population supported their membership in NATO. And now suddenly, what we have not been able to do, Vladimir Putin achieved in a matter of a month. Sweden and Finland are on track to become members of the North Atlantic Alliance. Now, it will have huge implications. First and most importantly, these are two very powerful, very solid democracies that will join NATO. This will strengthen the credentials of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization as an organization, as an institution that is run by democracies. Second, they're going to bring with them an incredibly well-equipped, well-trained, and NATO-compatible armed forces. And that is an important addition to the capabilities of the alliance. So I'm very pleased with this development. It's most unfortunate that it had to be triggered by war in Europe, but I think it is a huge development, and I welcome this development.
And how soon do you think accession could take place? For example, we know that a formal invitation will be extended to both Finland and Sweden at the upcoming NATO summit in Madrid in June. And historically, it takes about 6 months after the invitation to be ratified by all member states.
It could happen as early as June. And I guess at the next summit meeting, interestingly enough, Hungary, Czech and Poland was also invited at a summit meeting in Madrid. So it's symbolic for me. I was there when Hungary was invited, and it will be a great moment for Europe and for the transatlantic relationship.
Mr. Ambassador, another great moment, one could argue, but also a potentially destabilizing one, is the fact that there are so many Ukrainian refugees flooding into Poland and elsewhere in Europe. And of course, Vladimir Putin is hoping that this will destabilize Europe, that is, all the Ukrainian refugees, more than 4 million. What is your assessment of the ability for Europe to continue to absorb Ukrainian refugees? Will there be a breaking point? How do you see this particular dilemma?
I think we can absorb it. I think Europeans can absorb it. And I have to admit that I'm positively surprised at how well Ukrainian refugees have been received so far in Eastern Europe as well as Western Europe. Poland, of course, stands out with the 2.5 million refugees they're housing. It will be a huge burden on the economies of mainly the Eastern European, Central European countries, but it's doable. And it has to be a common European Union undertaking. We need to do this. I want to remind everyone that the refugee crisis in 2015 from Syria was actually triggered by Russia's aggression in Syria. And so I see a lot of similarities here. I believe the Europeans have learned a lesson. Europe was better prepared. And I am very pleased to see the way Europe is handling this. How long the solidarity of the man on the street will last? Well, that's a big question. But so far, I am positively surprised, and I'm deeply, deeply impressed by the way Europeans are handling this crisis.
Mr. Ambassador, turning now briefly to Ukraine's petition to join the EU, knowing full well that right now rattling the NATO cage is not a good idea. Zelensky has now just has concentrated on requesting EU accession. What is your view of that request?
Well, the Russians tried to prevent Ukraine's NATO accession before. They will not be able to prevent it now. It's a long process, but I'm very pleased that the political process has started and that documents have been exchanged and that they have sent in their application to the European Commission and that Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the Commission, is taking a leading role in pushing for Ukraine's future EU membership. Ukraine will be an incredible asset to Europe with the incredible, well-educated, Western-looking population they have. And so I'm pleased this is happening. And yet again, Vladimir Putin, I may say, shot himself in the foot because perhaps these positive steps and these courageous forward-looking steps would not have been taken by the Europeans had he not attacked Ukraine. This is a welcome development, and I'm looking forward to supporting Ukraine's accession process, getting rid of their earlier problems of corruption, all the economic and structural issues they've had. But I see a new, modern, and young Western-looking leadership in Ukraine that can definitely do this.
Ambassador Shimonyi, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about your native Hungary, which perhaps provides a bit of a contrast to what you described Ukraine as being. Again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but Hungary was quite a promising democracy once it threw off the Soviet yoke. But the Freedom House reports that there's major backsliding in democracy, and the president of Freedom House is basically saying Hungary is like a one-party state. There were recent elections where Prime Minister Viktor Orban won an unprecedented fourth term. He is seen as quite authoritarian. Talk about the developments in your native Hungary and how worried you may be with regard to its backsliding as a democracy, the very friendly relations that Orban has with Vladimir Putin. To what extent is this worrying in terms of Europe?
Well, let me say this. What is happening in Hungary is not supposed to happen. This is the biggest surprise in the last 30 years' history of Europe. Hungary, as you rightly said, was in the vanguard of the transition countries in turning a communist dictatorship to democracy. And then suddenly things started turning around. This would never have happened. On the one hand, without the presence of Russia, without Russian efforts to stop the democratization of Central Europe, without Russian active interference in the region. Two, without the naivete of some European leaders of what is happening in Hungary and perhaps also in other countries. No one saw the backsliding of democracy as a possibility. But it is what it is. And 2 weeks ago, there were elections in Hungary, and the opposition, the united opposition, lost badly, handing Viktor Orban another two-thirds supermajority. So he is once again in total and full control of the country. Let me say this. The elections might have been free in Hungary, but certainly they were not fair. In a country where 90% of the media is controlled by Viktor Orban, you cannot hold fair elections. Arguably, the opposition should have decided not to present its candidates for a vote this time around because of the unfairness and the unequal opportunity for the different parties. Of course, the opposition needs to do some soul searching as well. Viktor Orban is very good at feeling the temperature of the Hungarian people. He understands the man on the street much better than any Hungarian politician. But no way could an opposition win an election under these circumstances. I remember a year ago, some of us were pleading for Washington and Brussels to not to interfere with the elections, but to help create a level playing field. These pleas were not heeded. Nothing was done. And so my last point would be that there is a lot of responsibility to be shared, also outside responsibility. But all in all, Hungary is a canary in the coal mine and a warning sign that our democracies are vulnerable. And we have to be vigilant against efforts to turn back the time of history. It is really, really very sad because this, too, is about modernization. Hungary is supposed to be a developed, prosperous country on the level of Austria, Denmark, Holland, Sweden. And right now, it's a laggard. It's a laggard in its democratic credentials, but it's also a laggard and its economic performance. And the two go hand in hand.
Mr. Ambassador, your comments on Hungary really would open us up to an entire new program. But there is this tendency now for a rise in autocracy, authoritarianism, populism, nationalism in parts of Europe where the French are going to be voting as we speak. Never before have we seen Marine Le Pen, representing the far right party, receive so much popularity. At any rate, that's the topic for another program. Ambassador András Somogyi is the former Hungarian ambassador to the United States. He's now a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center. Ambassador Somogyi, I can't thank you enough for your time and terrific analysis. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.